All right. Our next presentation is by Dr. Peter Martland, who is a Cambridge-based historian and whose research interests mainly focus on the recording industry and the British and American secret intelligence industry. I understand that ARSC has wasted a lot of money over the last couple of years in recording these conferences. We could have gotten them from the NSA. Transcribed, as well as probably a lot of private conversations that occurred out in the hall and in the break room. But aside from that, about 20 years ago, I was in the UK on a buying trip and happened to find myself in London, where I attended a meeting of the City of London Phonograph and Gramophone Society, and to my delight, Dr. Martland was there presenting his new book, which was called Since Records Began, the First 100 Years of EMI. And since that time, he's come out with a new book in 2013, Recording History, the British Record Industry from 1888 to 1931. We are very honored and privileged to have him speak to us today on the American recording industry in the pit of the Great Depression, or the Eye of the Storm, a British view of the U.S. recording industry in 1931. Please welcome Dr. Peter Martland.
Thanks very much. This is really by way of a thank you to ARSC, because I got the award for the best historical research publication for this year, and it is appreciated. In 1933, 4 years into the Great Depression, the American recording industry was in a state of near collapse. Although this collapse has been well documented, there remain several unresearched aspects. For example, the widely differing experiences of the US and British recording industries. Both suffered the same startling disintegration. For instance, by 1938, few pre-1929 US record manufacturers had survived, and in Britain, only two, EMI and Decca, compared to 13 a decade earlier. Furthermore, there were significant differences in record sales trajectories. Overall, both the United States and British industries experienced the same 90% loss of sales. However, the time frame is starkly different. In 1928, 100 million records were sold in the United States, compared to 60 million in Britain. In 1933, the figure for the US was 10 million, and the British figure was the British figure for 1938 was 6 million. The United States therefore lost its market in 4 years. Whereas in Britain, it took fully 10. Though both economies suffered the same disintegration, the same stabilization, and the same growth after 1934. In fact, an examination of the post-depression upwards trend shows a much stronger US recovery. This meant that because of the Second World War and post-war austerity, it actually took Britain till 1959. To get back to 1928 volumes and values, whereas this was achieved in the US by 1942. However, it's the actual depression that is of interest to us today. And this discontinuity has puzzled me for some time, suggesting as it does other factors at play. Factors that were unique to the United States. This is important as, in my view, the Great Depression period was a critical juncture for this industry. destroying as it did pre-existing structures and at the same time laying the foundations for a new and, as it turned out, highly profitable industry that prospered for the following 50 years. Whatever you think, I believe the phenomena requires some kind of explanation. Now, the only detailed US company record sales figures for these years are those of the various Victrum-related labels. And these demonstrate the collapse of the long-established Victor premium-priced red and black label records from a combined peak, as you can see, of almost 36 million in 1928 to less than 2 million in 1933. Now, the figures also show the subsequent 1933 and 34 growth was not derived from the core product, but almost entirely from the new cheaper black Bluebird label selling at 35 cents each or three for a dollar. And, critically, from contract pressing. Why then did these core labels experience such a precipitous collapse and why such a sluggish post-1933 growth? Given that, by comparison, the 1933-34, the various equivalent premium-priced EMI labels were selling at around 50% of the 1928 levels. Now, in the course of my extensive researches in the EMI music archives during the late 1980s and early 90s, I found many key documents relating to the American record industry. Like most researchers, I used the relevant papers and left the rest. However, when I was recently preparing my research files for transfer to the University of California at Santa Barbara, I re-examined some of this material in photocopied form. Amongst them were extracts from the diary notes of Brenchley Ernest George Mittell, who was born in 1891 and died in 1981, a gramophone company and later EMI executive. He eventually became head of international artists and managing director of EMI Studios. In doing so, I remembered the extensive and hugely important collection of diary notes extending over nearly 30 years Mittell left behind when he retired in 1957. Now, this guy was recruited to the gramophone company in 1923 and was one of the new breed of record industry executives. He was educated to university level and electrical engineering, specializing in radio technology. Until the depression-driven creation of EMI in the spring of 1931, the 39-year-old Mittell had been a senior gramophone company executive, working closely with managing director, the American-born Alfred Clark, who he had himself come into the business in the 1890s, working first for Edison and then with Eldridge Johnson. A high flyer, Clark first came to Europe in 1899 and in 1908 became the third managing director of the Gramophone Company. In 1931, he was, as founding chairman of EMI, still the head of the business. In May of that year, Clark sent Mittell to the United States to discover the state of play over here in the teeth of the Great Depression and to make recommendation. Fortunately for us, Mittell, as usual, kept meticulously typed diary notes. They provide us with a unique and previously unknown account of the US recording industry at this critical juncture in its history, as told by key local players. And of course, these notes provide me with a wonderful foundation for this paper. Mittell was in New York in late May 1931. He described a visit he made to Henry C. Cox, the president and general manager of the Columbia Phonograph Company Limited at the company's fifth Avenue offices and recording studios. At the time, Columbia Phonograph was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Columbia Graphophone Company Limited, one of the merging companies forming EMI Limited. And its ownership was, as they met, being handed over to shareholders to avoid an antitrust investigation into EMI, in which RCA Victor held a 23% stake. In May 1931, Columbia Phonograph owned a number of subsidiary businesses in the United States, including OK Records and South America. It also held a portion of the shares in Japanese Nipponophone, the balance being held by Columbia Graphophone itself. At the time of the meeting, the Great Depression was taking the US and wider world economy into the pit. And it was in these circumstances that Cox, who was a highly experienced and well-known record industry executive, gave Mittal his views on Victor, Columbia, and the wider American recording industry. As Mittal noted, Mr. Cox first described the very great effects upon the gramophone and record trade of the Victor Company's changeover to radio, and gave a variety of information as follows. The Victor Company had given the dealers the impression that the phonograph and record business was finished and they were not going to pursue it seriously. The prominence of the Victor Company in the trade, with its trademark on which $100 million had been spent in advertising and which he thought was probably one of the best known trademarks in the world, had been such that the Columbia dealers had taken Victor's actions as a very strong evidence that the business was finished. All over the states, the Columbia salesmen had reported that the dealers took the attitude, look, it's useless to try and sell us phonographs and records. No, the fact of the Victor Company abandoning the business shows that they think it is dead and they must know. Later on, in effect, a reorganization of their distribution system. The RCA Victor had in almost every case where there was an RCA distributor in the town, same town, given the distribution to the RCA man and eliminated the Victor distributor. This is confirmed, according to Mittal, writing in brackets, by Major Lambert's offer to us of a large quantity of records at 5 cents each, which he said had been taken back by RCA Victor in reorganising the distribution system. Mr. Cox said that no doubt the phonograph and record business would have declined to some extent anyway, but in his opinion, the decline had been very much hastened and accentuated by the Victor Company's action. I think this is a very important statement. We had always known that RCA acquired the Victor Talking Machine Company in 1929, not for its record-making capacity, rather to access its Camden, New Jersey-based radio and player manufacturing facilities. By 1929, the manufacture of mechanical Victrolas had largely finished. The Camden factories were modern and manned by an experienced workforce. With this acquisition, RCA had benefited from the radio boom of these years. The need for the Camden factories was so great that the recording part of the acquisition really was marginal to the deal. However, Cox's comments do offer a fresh interpretation of the situation and a possible explanation why US sales fell off a cliff. We also know that Cox was at least in part wrong. As Sam Bulowski rightly points out, during this period, Victor never stopped making records. It was just that hardly anyone was buying them. Mittal continued, Mr. Cox had recently been told by the buyer that Victor had sold off all their electrical phonographs and acoustic phonographs, except portables, at very low prices. He believes something in the region of $15 for a very large model. The buyer sold them to chain furniture stores and mail order house, but they had not been able to dispose of them to the public. They are said to be still in Camden, though not on Victor Company property. Mr. Cox thought they might be disposed of in Europe or other territory outside the US. This shows RCA Victor clearing out its high value but non-selling Victrola inventory for the more lucrative radio market. In London, Alfred Clark was undertaking a similar exercise. Both businesses were evidently sidestepping their well-establishing networks in favour of the cut price firms. Why? Because the surviving dealerships were no longer prepared to stock these obsolete products. Now, if I may temporarily leave the meeting with Henry Cox to look at further evidence of the RCA position in 1931, Mittell later met with Walter Clark, a senior Victor executive who had previously worked for the Gramophone Company and who was the brother of Alfred Clark. Walter Clark gave the following stark assessment of RCA Victor's operation. After giving Mr. Clark news of his friends at Hayes, the Gramophone Company, I gave him Mr. Geisberg's inquiries about the RCA Victor Company's intentions as to renewals of contracts with artists. Mr. Walter Clark said until business improved, they did not intend to renew any contracts or make new ones. The record business in the US had fallen off, as we knew, and he thought it would continue to fall off in our territory on account of the gradual improvements in radio. But he did not think it would fall off to the same extent because in Europe there was more appreciation of standard music. In the United States at the present time, the people were only interested in jazz and crooning. RCA had not thought it worthwhile to develop whatever better class of market there might be, and 15 to 18 months ago had stopped advertising records. The whole artist department had been turned over to the NBC, and no real attempt had been made to take care of the special requests of the record trade. Today, Mr. Walter Clark was able to use NBC artists on an economical scale, or was able to get his own artists on as an addition. He was unable to estimate the future outlook for the record business of the RCA Victor Company, or what real plans of the RCA might be in regard to it. He personally still had great faith in the record business generally. Mr. Walter Clark agreed that, in point of view of the RCA Victor, the international arrangements with HMV were still important. In the past, these arrangements have been of most benefit to HMV, but today it was likely to be the other way round. And John Bollig has shown me that is exactly what happened for almost the next 10 years. And it's interesting, there's a marginal note here says, copy to Mr. Geisberg. Mr. Clark inquired whether the relationship between HMV and RCA were as friendly as in the past, saying he had noticed a definite change in outlook on this side of the Atlantic following the formation of EMI. Now, this statement is both illuminating and at the same time a pretty damning indictment of the RCA Victor position, confirming as it does the lack of interest in the recording industry. The failure to advertise new recordings further narrowed the opportunity for consumers to learn of the existence of the latest popular music, as always the key to any successful record company. The dropping of top Victor artists and the embargo on signing new talent was commented on by EMI executives in Britain, both at the time and subsequently, as the British company was tied to RCA, or they were tied to each other by a cross-licensing deal. David Bicknell, who joined the Gramophone Company in 1927 as an assistant to Fred Geisberg and went on to become head of international artists between 57 and 69, recalled the situation in a 1976 biography of his former boss. Up to that year, and he's talking about 1932, the artists had been equally divided, approximately in number and importance between the American and English companies, i.e. RCA Victor and HMV EMI. But in 1932, the Americans lost their nerve. And he says, I do not think this is too strong a word, and believe that the record business was finished. Victor started to unload artists, and Fred Geisberg, who had lost none of his faith in the record business, bound them to HMV one by one. He goes on, I remember one day coming back to my office after lunch and finding a cable reading, dropping DeLuca and Horowitz, stop. Any interest, Victor? It seems unbelievable today that such cables were arriving daily. Further evidence of these policies can be found in the caustic comments made by Nat Shilkret in his highly important biography. Equally, we know that many previously highly successful Victor recording artists who were under long-term contracts, like tenor John McCormack, whose contract ran to 1938, never made another US recording after 1930. Even a previously successful artist like Frank Crummett only made records at the Victor Studios post-1931 for the British market. This strategic change in the policies of the US record industry market leader seems to have infected the whole US industry, to which must be added that there were post-1929 less experienced dealerships and artist departments run by NBC, which, as Nat Shilkret showed, had little understanding of or interest in the recording industry. Furthermore, there was also the impact of radio. I'm more than happy to concede that, talking pictures, and most importantly, the whirlwind of the Great Depression. When put together, I think they simply finish off the recording industry in its then form. Now, back to the meeting with Henry Cox. Mittell inquired how Brunswick was getting along, and Cox said that for the past year, the financial reports recently made available by Warner Brothers had shown an operating loss by Brunswick of $1.2 million and a charge against surplus, which he took to mean loss on inventory, of about $2 million. This was offset by Warner's profits on pictures of about $700,000, leaving a net operating loss of approximately $500,000. He did not think Warner Brothers would be prepared to go on losing money on this scale for very long, and we know that they didn't, and quickly unloaded this loss-making business. Turning to the Carl Lindstrom business, acquired by the Columbia Graphophone Company in 1925, Cox had this to say, the American Columbia Company does not exchange matrices with Lindstrom, but the OK Record Company, a subsidiary of American Columbia, exchanges with Lindstrom and uses Lindstrom records under the Odeon label. The OK Company, however, has degenerated into a company selling old-time tunes and typical race records, as, for example, for Negroes and white hillbillies, which is put in inverted commas. There was a substantial volume of business in this line for several years, but it has lately fallen off badly. Victor Brunswick and some small companies also went into this business, but the coloured people have now got educated a little above the old-time typical stuff and have come up into the ordinary catalogues. The business depression, especially in the cotton industry in the South, has also hit the earnings of this class of customer. American Columbia does a fairly substantial business in the US in foreign language records, getting matrices from the English Columbia Company Foreign Recordings. American Columbia occupies a leading position in the US in foreign language records. Mr. Cox understood that Lindstrom was doing this year less than half the business they did last year. Now, turning to assessment of the wider industry, Cox said, 6 years ago, Columbia had urged Victor to bring out a cheap record for chain stores to meet the competition of the Perfect record. Perfect was alone in that business at the time and doing a tremendous turnover amounting to 30 to 40 million records. Simon Berlosky said these figures are highly contentious. He thinks 15 million max is what we're looking at. Victor refused, but American Columbia went into it with first success and good volume. Recently, Brunswick too went into it, but overdid it, selling to the chain stores at 15 cents, whereas Columbia Records retailed at 35 cents. Brunswick also put copyright numbers on both sides of the record instead of one, and we'll come back to that in a moment, and gave delivery from 7 points in the US. Which meant keeping up several stocks and paying freight to these points. After paying the 4 cents copyright out of 15 cents, then paying freight and seven large inventories out of the remaining 11 cents, that obviously could have been no profit in it. They got some business, but of course lost money, and Warners are expected to put a stop to it soon, and guess what they did. Now, reviewing these years, the greatest pre-depression change in the recording industry was the introduction in 1925 of the Western Electric System of recording. Victor, Columbia, and many other record companies embraced this technology, which was transformative, engendering a reinvention of the industry, and with it, the remaking of existing record catalogues. This system, of course, enabled the industry to record a much wider range of music, for example, full-scale orchestral works and live events. Furthermore, with the talking picture revolution just a few years later, the Western Electric monopoly of the audio market was taken a stage further. However, it all came at a price. Western Electric, through its subsidiary, Electrical Research Products Inc., ERPI, which handled its non-telephone interests, charged 5 cents per record sold in the US and one penny in the UK. By the pit of the Depression, this heavy tax pressed down on the industry on both sides of the Atlantic. And it was in these circumstances that Mattel was naturally to learn more about ERPI and its business. He said, during the course of the conversation, Mr. Cox told us he was still on good terms with the WE, though he had some arguments with them about his making 16-inch records for advertising agencies to supply to broadcasting stations. Later, he showed his offices and studios into which he had recently moved with considerable increase in economy and efficiency. The total floor area is 32,000 square feet. There were two large studios and two smaller ones. These were very well equipped, and WE engineers had been brought in to help in their design. Mr. Cox's contract with WE had, of course, began before the day of Mr. Otterson in ERPI. He found Otterson pleasant but very hard. He referred to Otterson as the czar of the talking film industry. He had asked him for a reduction in the scale of royalties for the cheap record business, but been refused. He found himself at a disadvantage against the cheap competition who didn't use Western Electric on this account. He said, though, that there were quite a number of independent recording companies which had sprung up in connection with talking films, and he did not think WE's patent position was strong enough to stop them. Such was Mattel's interest in ERPI that he continued this discussion with Walter Clark at Victor. And particularly about the machine, what was known as the orthophonic or reentrant horn machine designed in 1925, to which both Victor and the Gramophone Company had purchased manufacturing rights. We then discussed the contracts with ERPI. In this connection, it was stated that the Victor Acoustic Machine contract had a minimum guarantee of $100,000 per annum, of which they were, in 1931, earning no more than $3,000 to $4,000. In the last 2 years, they'd paid $175,000 more than they'd earned. Walter Clark and a colleague had started discussion with Otterson on the basis that the minimum guarantees on the acoustic machine contract and the talking film contract had very considerably exceeded the royalty earnings of the last 2 years. And the technical advantages which Otterson people had made in loudspeakers and other electrical devices had themselves contributed to the falling off of the business in acoustic machines. Mr. Walter Clark had not proposed to modify minimum guarantees in the case of the recording contract. The minimum was $50,000 per year in the US, although the apparatus used was not the newly developed Fortiphone equipment. Their suggestion would have practically saved Victor about $1 million for the rest of the life of these contracts and had been broadly acceptable to Mr. Otterson. But, and this is where you get the chicanery kicking in. I gather that it was finally not acceptable to RCA themselves and had been withdrawn. The idea seems to have been that the contracts were with the Victor Talking Machine Company, which was now only a shell, and that ERPI would be unable to collect. They're using the law of contract. So, what conclusions can we draw from this important source? Perhaps the most obvious one we already knew, that during this year, the US recording industry experienced a spectacular collapse. However, though this cyclical downward movement was primarily caused by the Great Depression, it was compounded by a range of other problems. Some of these were inflicted by RCA. Its strategy marginalized the record industry by destroying the long-established and highly experienced retail dealerships, by handing over to the artist department to NBC Radio Artists Department, by failing to sign up new talent, by getting rid of existing talent, and by ending record advertising. Taken together, these sent a clear message to both the trade and to consumers. It wasn't simply the action of RCA. One has to throw into the balance the fixed rate tax imposed by Western Electric, and in the age of the cheap record, by the equally fixed rate copyright tax. Taken together, these reduced profits at a time of very tight margin. All that said, I am quite convinced that the bitter storm of the Great Depression remained the greatest agent of downward pressure. However, the other structural and strategic issues I have brought to your attention, in my opinion, compounded an already dire situation and was responsible for pushing the industry into a phase of even deeper disintegration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have time for a couple of questions. Tim?
There is a rather provocative article in the current issue of the Ars Journal.
Yeah, I've just been told about it.
Which I'm paraphrasing here, I hope I'm getting it right, premises that the combination of HMV and Columbia into EMI in 1931 was driven not so much by the depression and the falling sales as it was by a scheme by RCA in the U.S. and largely by David Sarnoff specifically to create a monopoly or a semi-monopoly in Britain where he could get the pesky Columbia competition out of the way, so to speak. What is your opinion of that?
I think that's nonsense.
Okay, very good. Nonsense it is.
Oh, nonsense. I'm sorry, did you not hear? I think it's nonsense. I think that argument is nonsense.
Someone else. We have time for a lot of questions at that rate. Anyone? That's right. Okay.
Gosh, I've frightened you all. Thank you very much. I'm sorry?
I'm just personally, you know, looking at some of these early victors from that time period, we run across occasionally artists that you just think, why didn't they sell these things? I mean, we understand depression and the low sales and so forth, but there are other records, a lot of dance band stuff that turns up quite regularly.
Absolutely.
But then you find things like the Baby Rosemarie victors and Mae Questel and the Ink Spots first record on Victor Scroll. I mean, those things are just tremendous rarities. I have no idea why those wouldn't have sold when some of the dance band stuff did. Do you have any comment on that?
In fact, I do. I'm probably the best person than me to answer this is John Bollig, who's read the ledgers. The pressure within the recording studio, singers have to bring and pay for their own accompaniment, arrange for their own music parts to. I mean, there's a whole range of new restrictions clearly being brought in that is discouraging it. But I think, you know, the comments are being made by Walter Clark, are very clear that there's no interest and there's no money for investment in this industry.
Well, I guess Frank Crummett was probably passé by that point in the U.S.
But, he certainly wasn't in Britain, and he was certainly having a highly successful radio career. He had a daily show in New York. I mean, he had a profile in New York on the radio. The idea that he'd fallen out of favor doesn't seem to wash. Certainly, his records were still selling in Britain in significant numbers, to the point that he was still going into the recording studio here, but only for the British market.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much.
Not at all.